the Nighthawk, a.k.a. the Stealth Fighter, one of the most amazing planes ever built, a powerful weapon system way ahead of its time, a deep, dark secret for so very long, has officially retired. That's the story we've been told. So why do people keep seeing it flying around? Why do people keep, if they work really hard at it, that is, why do they keep getting photographs of the F-117 floating around? We figured the person to ask might be Tyler Rogway, who's an aviation and military journalist who's chased down a lot of stories about black projects, black programs, amazing weapon systems and platforms, and even UFOs now and then. Tyler will join us in a moment to talk about the Nighthawk and other secret projects in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Tyler Rogaway has been obsessed with all things aviation and military as long as he can remember. He's a journalist who developed a defense-oriented website, Foxtrot Alpha, and you can find a lot of his work right now on something called thedrive.com, the war zone. He's written recently about mysteries of the F-117, but his work goes a lot further than that, and I've wanted to have him on the program a long time. Tyler, way overdue. Glad to have you here.
Hey, it's great to be here, George.
Let's start with this. How did you end up having this as your beat?
You know, it's weird. I was growing up, other kids love sports, and we're to this or that. For me, it was always defense technology, and especially the aerospace side. So, you know, I've had different other passions as well, but this always, you know, preceded it, and it sort of chose me more than anything else. I did my own just blog because I cared about the subject, and I saw kind of an opening that people weren't, an angle that people weren't approaching it from, and that ended up being syndicated, and then, you know, going from there to developing multiple platform sites for multiple platforms, and now we're at thewarzone.com today. It's sort of the site I've always wanted to read myself, and that's how I produce it on a daily basis, is just, is this something I'd love to read, and isn't out there, and it's been greatly successful.
So you're the boss. You get to pick what you write about.
I'm very lucky. I got a great deal. Yep.
Are you from a military family?
No, not at all. I don't have any of that in my background. It's kind of the strangest setup. It's just an odd fascination since I was young. And from that, it just, you know, studying the topic over the years. And, you know, I went to school in college. I did, you know, political science and history and tried to cross over anywhere I could. But it's such a unique domain. But that kind of that background allows me to approach it in a different way. I haven't signed NDAs with the government. You know, I don't have to deal with any of those issues. So we do airspace, land, sea, cyberspace, and geopolitics all in one basket, and we fuse it all together. And it's a lot of fun, and it's at least something different than I think anybody else is doing out there.
Well, you know, a lot of the work and the things that you write about are in the white world, and a lot of it is in the black world. And in
right.
both of those, you need relationships, right? You need
Absolutely.
To know people to get access and to give you information, tell you where and when to be.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what we do is open source, and that's sort of, you know, that's the breadcrumbs that allow us to sort of know where to look. But yeah, obviously, you gain quite a source book over time, and, you know, people that, a lot of times it's people that are following you that are interested in just giving you any tips and whatnot. But there's a lot out there that is not classified that allows you to make good inferences as far as what is classified and what you don't see. And we've been very accurate in that regard, and that's really been a good part of our success.
You find you have to walk a fine line. You mentioned that you don't have to sign any NDAs, non-disclosure agreements. You wouldn't get yourself into that situation. But have you found yourself where you find information that might be classified, that might reveal the existence of something that maybe the rest of the world doesn't need to know about?
You know, there's always that. You know, you look at every case by case. You know, and as far as things go, what I'm most concerned about is, you know, when things come across my desk that are operational, like happening now, that could potentially be an issue, that's really where you want to stay away from the most, in my opinion. But at the same time, you know, we do believe in the public's right to know. And, you know, we can talk about some of these concepts that actually have a huge impact on the budget, the defense budget, where and how we're spending money, and have a much larger interest than just, oh, that's a cool airplane that I didn't know about before. And a lot of times things are classified not because they're just a technology that needs to be remained undisclosed. It's because they don't want things to compete with other programs or they don't want funding to have to go through the funding process in the white world. So there's a whole other world to this than just like pointing out something that people didn't know exists that does prove a good value to, you know, to people, to the citizens that are paying for all this stuff, whether they like it or not.
This is goes back years ago, but my two mentors in journalism, a guy named Ned Day and a guy named Bob Stodall, who was they hired me at KLAS long, long ago at the dawn of time. They worked together before I was there on a story about this amazing airplane. They didn't know what it was called at the time, but that it was had a weird reflective surface that made it virtually invisible to radar. And Ned broke the story in a newspaper, North Las Vegas newspaper. And as a result of printing that story, and then it got onto television, he gets rounded up by these federal agents who pull him in. It was a scene right out of a movie. They put him in a room, a darkened room with a bright light in his face, and asking him where he got the information. And didn't he know that he was endangering national security and the lives of 200 million Americans by letting this information out? And why would he do something like this to let our adversaries know? And Ned was pretty nervous at the time. And then it occurred to him that his response was this, and I would imagine you would say something like this as well, that if he, as a columnist for a little tiny North Las Vegas newspaper, could find this information out, then surely the Russians or other adversaries with much greater resources would be able to find it out as well. And if they thought they had a secret, they didn't. You ever have yourself in that kind of a situation?
Obviously, you know, some people that are looking at open source information almost primarily, you know, compared to the intelligence services of Russia and China. I mean, it's like it's a whole different world, you know. So that's definitely something that I think is a good way to put it, and it actually makes sense. But yeah, it's honestly, George, it's kind of the public's need to know and the right to know versus what some people don't want to tell you. I mean, this is a long battle that goes way back. And, you know, you go by your gut and everything else. But, yeah, definitely. I mean, we're not have any special advantage over, like you say, like China or like Russia. I mean, give me a break.
So we advertised this. The headline of your appearance was about the F-117, and we will talk about that now. It's not going to be the totality of it, but the F-117, pretty amazing plane. A friend of ours who writes about aviation stuff, he's out there in the desert with binoculars and taking notes all the time. He has his own website. We'll send it out via Twitter, Lazy G Ranch, and he takes photos. And he's seen these F-117s, the Nighthawks, still flying around up there near Tonopah. I wonder if you have a theory on the story that they're retired and what it is that they might be doing since they've been seen certainly outside of the hangars in and around Nevada.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually did a post when the first video of them flying came out probably in 2012, which was 4 years after they were officially retired. And these airplanes were not sent to the boneyard, you know, down in Tucson, Arizona. They actually were put back at their ancestral home at Tonopah Test Range Airport, where they lived in the black in secrecy through the 1980s. They were stored there in one, roughly, you know, four to hangar, so taking up 13 hangars. It's about 52 of the aircraft remaining at that time. And there's like 57 of these hangars up there. So not a lot of space, but they're stuffed in there, and they're kept in what's called Type 1000 storage, which means you could regenerate them within a number of months in an emergency, and that was congressionally mandated. So it's not like they were retired and mothballed fully. They were kind of in this purgatory state. Another reason why they went up there, George, instead of down in Tucson, is they were still considered highly sensitive, and they didn't have the security in place to store them, even at the government's boneyard there at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base. So fast forward a few years, and people all of a sudden are seeing them flying again. And I did a big piece about that kind of went everywhere. And it's really, there's a few theories that make sense, one of which is that they are flying in very small numbers as aggressors. They are flying as the bad guys against our pilots flying F-15s, F-16s, F-22s, etc., to show a dissimilar low observable platform, because we've never had to fight an enemy with a stealth airplane, and that's changing. Okay, so that's one thing. The next one was to be potentially tested as a conversion into an unmanned aircraft. And the F-117 as an unmanned platform is kind of attractive. It has some capabilities and already built into it that make it easier to do that than a normal fighter. So that's one side of it. And then finally, the one that really makes the most sense, and today we actually have more evidence on, is to use them as a test aircraft, as basically a control variable for new low observable coatings and technologies. And what that means is the F-117 is the most studied stealth aircraft in American history. So they have all this data on its signature, its radar and infrared signature. By changing the coatings, you can retest the aircraft and see if it helped it as far as visibility of certain radar bandwidths or if it hurt it. And the same is true for infrared. And there's a facility at Groom Lake called the DICOMS facility, which is a big array of radars that is built specifically to do this. To test an airplane flying through the air, not on a pole, a real aircraft flying around and seeing exactly what its return looks like on various radar systems. So the F-117, which has been, you know, supposedly retired for quite a while, you can see how it still has a very attractive test potential still in it.
Yeah, it's an amazing plane even now. The idea that, I mean, maybe address the idea of how far ahead of its time it was, if it can, we're still learning stuff from it now.
Yeah, that's super true. We're still learning, like, basic components of this thing, and maybe some of the things that never made it into the operational state that they were looking at, which are really exciting, and we cover those stories, but as far as this, ahead of its time, in the mid-1970s, you know, this whole stealth revolution was very quietly happening within the aerospace world, but nobody really knew how to exactly do it, like a concept that could really make it congeal into something that could be put in an operational airframe. Lockheed Skunk Works used a Russian scientist, mathematician's work to build a computer program, which at that time was, you know, building a computer program for something like this was very advanced, that would actually model the different radar returns of different shapes. And from that, they came up with a shape called the Hopeless Diamond. And it was like literally kind of like a little diamond that they could mold into an aircraft that could fly. And from that came an aircraft called HAV Blue, which was the precursor technology demonstrator for the F-117. It was widely successful as far as the aims of that small program, and that gave birth to the F-117. And so all the way even past the time that it was living in secrecy at Tonopah, into the 1990s, where it was part of Desert Storm and it was part of the Bosnia operation, and even into 2003, it was still operating, you know, against Iraq in the 2003 invasion. It was always at the point of the spear. It was always at the front. So the aircraft, when it was retired, actually made some, kind of kicked up some controversy, because there was nothing that we knew about that was unclassified that could take its place directly. The ability to place a laser-guided bomb in particular, not just a bomb, but a 2,000-pound laser-guided bomb very accurately, pretty much anywhere inside the enemy's air defense network. The only aircraft that could do anything close to that was a B-2, and that would have been a GPS-guided weapon, which has limitations. And we only have 20, at the time, 21 B-2s. So, you know, even when it was retired, a lot of people were questioning the reason why, and really we lost the capability, at least in, you know, from our view, when they actually sent them up there to Tonopah.
What about spare parts?
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge part, right? But you got to remember, Lockheed kept these airplanes flying for decades. So, you know, they had enough to keep them up during that period of time. And that was not the parts and maintainability was really not the reason they got rid of it. The F-117 was always expensive to fly. That wasn't anything new. Every low observable aircraft is. The F-22 is as well. The F-35 is. Okay, so that hasn't changed. But really, it had to do with this sort of cost-cutting, downsizing measure. And like I say, it's what we see, right? We see, okay, there's a capability gap. There probably wasn't. There probably is a capability. We can talk about this later, but that eventually at least filled in this space and did it in a much more capable way than even the F-117 was able to do.
The idea about the F-117s being sort of the aggressor in various military exercises, that would not exactly be unknown up in TTR, Tonopah Test Range, Area 52. we know that, and I'm sure you've written about it, about the aggressor squadron of the Russian planes that they had up there for a long time.
Right. Yeah. The Red Eagle squadron were up there. And that was 70s, 80s. They were, you know, flying MiGs against captured or conjured up MiGs against our fighter pilots. That was a very clandestine program. And that really was the birth of Tonopah Test Range Airport. That's when it started to expand in the 70s before the F-117 was to fly these aircraft, these Russian actual real MiG-21, MiG-23, you know, and MiG-17 aircraft against our fighters. And that was for test purposes at a certain period of time, but actually became an aggressor, as you state, an aggressor squadron that would give our pilots an actual, not a plane that flies similar to a Russian fighter, but the exact aircraft they could actually fly against. And that was, a lot of that was to reduce what's called buck fever, is when a pilot first sees an enemy aircraft, they can train and train and train for it, but they can freeze up. And actually going there and seeing what a MiG looks like in real time in the cockpit really changed things. And that hasn't stopped. That still continues to this day. It's just not happening at Tonopah. It's happening at Area 51.
And has that been measured? Is there a metric by which that's measured that in real life in combat since then?
Yeah, I mean, the Top Gun program that came out of the late 60s, the experience over Vietnam, that was part of that, was threat simulation to give them. That's why the airplanes are painted in the similar colors as well, our aggressors, our F-16s today, that fly an aggressor service for the Air Force. They're painted just like Chinese or Russian aircraft. But when the buck fever thing happened, I mean, I've heard that anecdotally from pretty much every aggressor pilot or person that's flown against an aggressor, or even has to do with the Red Eagles program. So it definitely was part of trying to desensitize the pilots to that wow factor of if they find themselves actually in a place where they have to pull the trigger, they're not overwhelmed by actually seeing this threat that they've been taught so much about for so long, actually real in front of them, inside their gun pipper or their missile lock inside their hood. So there definitely is something with that, and it worked. It worked. It was a highly successful program, and now there's books about it you can read. Red Eagles is probably the best one. I would check that out for your listeners.
Can you address the idea of, okay, so we had the F-117, we're way ahead of the rest of the world, that was then. What about now? And not necessarily F-22 and F-35, but how the F-117 would stack up against what our adversaries would have now?
Well, the F-117 was never a panacea for, it's never invisible, it's not a panacea for air defenses. Like, the F-117... Stealth in general is a cocktail of technologies. Okay, the aircraft is not just it alone. It has electronic warfare plays a huge part in it, being able to jam the enemy radars or confuse them at a distance so that F-117 can make it in and have a higher chance of survivability. Mission planning and the software that goes into it was almost as important for the F-117 as the actual airframe. And today, we have cyber technology. So being able to go in and hack into the enemy's air defense system and turn their radars off or put a worm in there that makes it go haywire at just the right time are all part of making stealthy aircraft successful. So it's not just like, what's the new airplane? It's also what goes with it. But for the future, George, it's all about unmanned technology. And all this stuff about like a sixth-generation fighter that people talk about is a joke. It's a joke.
Well, we're going to get into that. I do want to get into that. I want to ask you also, are we working on an invisible plane? Not invisible to radar, but invisible. And about any other kind of secret things that might be on the horizon. We're talking with Tyler Rogaway, and we'll be right back after this. We're talking with Tyler Rogaway about military programs, military secrets. Secrets can be kept. The popular mythology is that big secrets can't be kept, that Washington leaks like a sieve, the Pentagon leaks like a sieve. In fact, though, secrets can be kept. Secrets are kept. So it makes you wonder what else is out there flying around in the desert. We're going to get into that in a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. So, Tyler, after the 117 was mothballed, sort of, we know that the two projects that replaced it, at least in part, the F-22 and F-35, seems like when we read about those airplanes, as amazing as they are, it's about some problem or a budget issue or something. Could you share with me how much of a leap those two planes represent over the F-117 and a sense of how much further ahead of the rest of the world those airplanes are?
So the F-35 and F-22, they're just like a massive quantum leap over the F-117, in pretty much every way you can imagine. Let's just take the F-35 because it's the newest, and that kind of gives you at least the best way to describe this. But you know, the F-117 was very much like when a pilot flew that aircraft, they were in a box. They did not communicate with anybody. They had to navigate to their target literally passively, where they, you know, there's no outside source of information that they could transmit. Fast forward to today, just the ability of information sharing, the ability of the data links that the F-35 has and the F-22, where they can even share information between each other in a very stealthy way, or to all different platforms and gather information and present it to the pilot. It's what we call sensor fusion. It's just a game changer. It gives you a god's eye view of the battle space around you and allows you to act almost more, not as a fighter pilot, but as like a battle commander or like a quarterback of a football team. And that is a major force multiplier for not just the other F-35s in your area, it's for all the aircraft in your area. So just on the, not the stealthiness of the aircraft or its raw performance, which are light years ahead of the F-117 on those areas as well. The fact that the pilot has so much information to make really good decisions and know what's going on in the world around him or her is really maybe the biggest leap in capability over an aircraft like the F-117.
Compare it to the best that the Russians might have. Say we're in some kind of a conflict, either against the Russians or against Russian surrogates.
Right. So the Russians have the best thing that they have is the Su-57. That aircraft does not compare to the F-22 or the F-35. Russia has trouble with stealth technology. They just don't have the knowledge base or the manufacturing capabilities to pull off something like an F-35 or even close to it, or an F-22. It's just something we've seen over and over. And so what they do is they take a balanced approach, George. They look and say, okay, what can we, how can we balance cost, the low observable stealth technology that we can apply, and then bring in new sensors and systems. So you end up with some kind of innovative things on those airplanes. But when it comes to like a one-to-one capability, it's not even close, okay? And especially when we talk about the networking and the big picture capabilities we just discussed, it's like night and day. So that's not happening. China is the forefront peer competitor with the United States technologically. And we see this in the aerospace realm especially. They are building stealth fighters now that are, no, they are not as stealthy as what we have. No, they don't have the sensors that we have, but they're capable. They can build them in potentially large numbers. And you got to always remember, they're fighting from home. They're not in an expeditionary fight like we would be if we faced off against them. And above all else, they build everything that they build or they design is really focused at cutting into America's Achilles heel. And with like their J-20, which is their large stealth fighter, that aircraft has a lot of gas, meaning it can fly long ranges and without being refueled by a vulnerable tanker. And that is part of their anti-access strategy, being able to push us out where we can't even get close enough to attack targets on the Chinese mainland or on their territorial holdings in the area. They're also designing very long-range air-to-air missiles that can take out our tankers potentially and our airborne early warning aircraft. Without the tankers, the fighters are useless. They fall into the sea. Your listeners have to understand that even an F-35, which has a decent range, it can only fly 600 miles before it needs, and back before it needs fuel. So it's not like you can launch one of those from Guam and it's going to just fly over into Chinese airspace and hit a target and fly back. It is going to need refueling constantly on an air bridge all the way there and back. And if those tankers are vulnerable, the aircraft doesn't make a difference how stealthy it is.
You know, we've seen in the last 2 or 3 years or so some pretty provocative acts by the Russians flying really close to various platforms that we have, ships and some boasts about their hypervelocity missiles and hypersonic missiles, what they could do, indefensible, that kind of thing. Do you have any sense of how accurate the boasts are and whether there's something that they've got that we don't know about or need to worry about?
That's a great question. And really, it fills up our headlines on a daily basis today, whether you're into this topic or not. So Russia's capabilities, they've basically designed a number of what I call super weapons that are low density. You don't build a ton of them, but they're strategically a troubling to the United States. Really hypersonic weapons, which are able to fly above Mach 5, where they're going so fast that we really don't have a way to A, knock them down, or even like the ability to like detect them and have the decision cycle fast enough to engage them, even if we could. So the hypersonic weapons are a problem. They do have what looks like a hypersonic weapon that is almost reaching operational capability. That's an issue. Those things can be targeted at our command centers in Europe, and we don't have really a good way to shoot them down, but we are working on it. We are already working on a countermeasures for all this. That includes a space-based tracking layer where we can track these things in flight and also potentially a way to intercept them. But there are other ones, like Russia has gone and built a underwater unmanned vehicle that's nuclear powered that can basically come off our shores and detonate itself with a very large nuclear warhead that is specifically built to create a large tidal wave that's radioactive and just take out entire cities on the coastline. This isn't something that is like, shown in a comic book. This is something they're working on and they're testing. So, but it's also a sign of weakness too. If you're having to develop these like oddball,
Doomsday, like doomsday weapons or something like
right, exactly. You're already at a point, if you're doing that, if you're employing that weapon system, the world's probably going to come to an end within 30 minutes, at least as we know it, okay? So it's kind of almost like, is this just a lot of foreplay? I believe it is. I think, yeah, the weapons can be better and better and more capable, but no matter what, we still have those Trident missile submarines sitting, making a hole in the ocean. And if something happens like that, guess what? All of Moscow's gone, all of Russia's gone. All of the main cities in Russia are wiped off the map. They don't have a weapon that can stop that. So it's, you got to look at it all in context, but there is a lot of propaganda value that Putin and Russia get out of these so-called super weapons.
Of course, the next step that has been written about and speculated are the unmanned fighters that you've talked about. You've written about it, and in fact, you've written about it as a mystery. Like, where are they? So, where are they?
Right. So this is like one of my pet projects I've taken on. We found this big black hole basically where the government built these things with Boeing and with Lockheed and with Northrop Grumman. They tested what's called unmanned combat air vehicles. And what that means is basically it's an unmanned stealthy aircraft that's about the size of a fighter jet. Okay. Doesn't have the performance or speed of a fighter jet, but it has much longer range and is much harder to track. It's much more stealthy. Okay. And really, they tested this in, like I say, in the white world, unclassified, in the early 2000s. It was the biggest game-changing capability, even in that proto state, since the jet engine. Okay, we're talking like bigger than stealth. As the decade wore on, it looked like, okay, this is going to be a large part of the future force structure, and it just disappeared, vanished. If you look at documentation from the Air Force over the last 10 years, it went from talking about UCAS as being part of the future to not even ever being mentioned. It's like a dirty word.
Well, you can
So,
read a lot into that.
yes, exactly. So there's two things that happened, and this is a huge piece I did on this, lays out the entire story. But there's really two things. A, they didn't move forward on them, or if they did, it's in a very small, test state. And that's probably part of the culture. This will replace the pilot, the fighter pilot, which runs the Air Force. Okay, huge cultural thing. People that discount that don't know this world. So don't even listen to them. If they think, oh, it's really not that big of a deal. No, the end of the fighter pilot is a very, very big deal. The end of any pilot in the Air Force is a very big deal. So did they slow roll it possibly and just kept it as a very small testing, which is definitely being tested. Okay, absolutely. We have multiple reasons to believe that. But on the other hand, they have it in the exact same state as like the F-117 was in the 1980s, which I believe they do. And that would allow them to have a small pocket force that they could play with and they could, test and use, but they could potentially use operational. Here's the problem with that. It's such a game-changing technology, not just because it's better at striking a target or fighting the enemy. It's because you don't need to train pilots anymore. You don't need to fly these airplanes. Once you build them, you test them. You just test the concepts of how they operate. You park them in a garage. Like, it changes everything. It changes the whole way we operate as an air arm, or as the America's air arm should operate. So, and it with a big, above all else, it influences the budget. Why do you need 1,750 F-35s if this thing could fly three times as far, is much more stealthy, and it could work as a network team faster than humans could ever work together to basically rip apart the enemy's decision cycle and take out targets, and especially their air defense nodes? Why do you need 1,700 F-35s if that technology is sitting right here? Oh, and by the way, they cost a third of the price of an F-35, or a quarter of the price. And you don't have to fly them, and you don't need a pilot. You see what I'm saying? You see how this is building?
Yeah, it's
So,
kind of scary. You know what comes to mind for me is Skynet.
right. It does for a lot of people. But I have to say that that is also really mischaracterized, because what we're talking about here are aircraft that react to electromagnetic stimuli, meaning they can detect radar sites and attack radar sites, or classify those targets and work as a team to take them out or avoid them. Okay, so they do multiple things, or they hit a target that a Tomahawk missile would anyway. So it's already a robot going and hitting a fixed target somewhere, at a certain place. If you take just those two roles and leave close air support and all the stuff that are more complicated roles out of it, you're not talking about a craft that goes around and targets school buses accidentally. It doesn't have that capability to do it. So we're not talking about AI here. We're talking about software. But yeah, it definitely conjures up those visions. And sadly, that's also a reason why there's probably some pushback, is that there it's misunderstood really what like a swarming drone capability means, and what its capabilities and how limited they can be based on how they're designed and the program that goes into them.
Address the idea about secrecy. Sometimes you got to figure secrecy goes too far. That the steps are taken that are just seemingly over the line. Then again, you got a lot of people who would argue secrets can't be kept. There's no such thing. Washington leaks like a sieve. Everything that's every black project, it comes spilling out. Can secrets be kept, and can they be kept for a long time?
Whoever says that secrets cannot be kept in this world that we're talking about is flat out wrong. We have, especially Lockheed, has designed, with the Skunk Works early on with the U-2 and everything else, SR-71. They designed an institution of secrecy that is way beyond what you see in Washington, D.C. It's when you talk about what do the Skunk Works make, you can name all the airplanes, but really the ability to keep things very secret and to get to a prototype really fast and to accelerate and turbocharge the development process of exotic aircraft and secret programs is really something, maybe their greatest product they ever made. Okay, and that has been instilled in all different domains in this classified realm. Let me give you proof of this. So Area 51, you can look on a satellite image of all the hangar space that's there. And we've heard anything from 25 to 55 programs at one time that are going on there, some of them flying, some of them not. But there's a lot of action that's done there. It's a major flight development place, clandestine flight development area for the United States Air Force and the Marines and the Navy and the industry. So it's a very busy place. We have seen since, like, what, 1981, like going back to 1981, we've seen maybe, what, four airframes that have come out of that have been disclosed. Four airplanes. Now, I can assure you that there's a lot more going on there than four airplanes over all that time that were just tested. These aren't even production planes. These are just, articles, test articles. I think what's there is hundreds and hundreds of aircraft that we'll probably never know about, and a lot of them get buried. They literally get buried in the ground out there. So the idea that somehow we know everything and everything leaks is just preposterous, and that's just not accurate.
What about insect-sized drones? I've been hearing that for at least 10 years about a research on that. Maybe they're flying out there at Area 51.
Right. So I did a piece probably 10 years ago about this. And yeah, that's sort of like the ultimate weapon, right? Instead of dropping a or sending a bunch of Marines into a village to try to kill the bad guys, once the civilians are out, you just unleash the the insect-sized drones basically that just kill them. They inject them, or they explode next to their head with a small charge. I mean, there's many ways to kill a person with a small insect like that. I believe that that technology is very well developed in certain areas, especially for surveillance, and especially with our intelligence agencies that are using certain things like that. Now, the big question is, how do you control it? How do you do it beyond line of sight without losing the connection on something that small, battery power, a bunch of other things? But we know right now that there's plenty of drones that are being built that look like birds, that look like fish in the water. And that's a way of stealth technology, just like a diamond-shaped airplane. So yeah, I do think that this is the future. And you can just think about how hard it is going to be to defend people, especially VIPs, against that type of technology. Once it proliferates, just like how I predicted this whole hobby drone thing would have a very dark side to it, and it did. And the government, the military sat and waited. And they should have seen that coming a million miles away, and they didn't until it was too late, and now they're trying to catch up. You'll see the same thing when you talk about micro drones that are so small that, they can fit on a head of a on your pinky or head of a pin.
I just posted an article that you probably saw it about the Kalashnikov kamikaze drone. I guess that's what you're talking about being predictable.
Yeah, Israel developed that technology long ago. They have a Harpy and see what are the systems? Harpy and HAROP are the two suicide drones they built a long time ago. Prop powered, they take out air defense systems, or they take out targets of opportunity, and they can even be reused. Now that technology has just made it so much it's just come down the commercial pathway where anybody can potentially weaponize one of these things, and it's really scary. Some of the things you're going to see, be really, you're going to get really accustomed to seeing solid state laser systems around VIPs. Like when they get off an airplane or they go and do an appearance, you're going to see a truck there with a solid state laser that can shoot these things down without sending a bullet flying through the air for 10 miles. It's going to change the way we live, and how security is looked at. And as you discussed, as these things miniaturize, it's going to get all that much, much harder to create a sanitary, safe environment, especially for people that have a real big security risk as it is.
Yeah, I can see like the Pope Mobile will need a force field around it or something.
Right. And a lot of this has to do with electronic warfare too. Let me just get that in. Is electronic, you can kill something with a hard kill, with a weapon that hits it, kinetically destroys it. But even the smallest of drones, if you can break its ability to either function electronically or to communicate with whoever's commanding it, that's a way to soft kill it. And that's just as important. So there's going to be things that you can see that are kinetic and also non-kinetic, ways to disrupt these drones. And it's already happening. They're already being deployed in multiple ways, just as we talk now.
We're talking with Tyler Rogway about black projects, the future of aviation and military technology, a lot of other secrets on the horizon out there that we'll get into next, some even more exotic than what we've talked about.